or call our pledge line. It's open 24 hours a day. That number is 212-209-2950. It's 9 o'clock here in New York City over WBAI 99.5 FM. Coming up next, Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize for another world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Now, Jeff Halper on decolonizing Israel, liberating Palestine, Zionism, settler colonialism, and the case for one democratic state. Jeff Halper is the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and a co-founder of the One Democratic State campaign. He's written several books on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and is a frequent writer and speaker across the globe about Israeli politics, focusing mainly on nonviolent strategies to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Halper was nominated together with the Palestinian intellectual and activist Ghassan Andoni for the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for his work to liberate both the Palestinian and the Israeli people from the yoke of structural violence and to build equality between their people by recognizing and celebrating their common humanity. Halper accuses Israel of being guilty of apartheid and a deliberate campaign to Judaize the occupied Palestinian territories and is a supporter of the BDS boycott, divestment, sanction movement and the academic boycott of Israel. Jeff, a self-described Israeli and Palestine, speaks to us from the area on decolonizing Israel, liberating Palestine, Zionism, settler colonialism, and the case for one democratic state. Jeff, it's good to have you with us. Let me start with a very personal question. For those of us in this country, the U.S., and for those of us working with liberal organizations and so on, there has been a ferocity of accusations of anti-Semitism to shut down any voices that would dare to suggest equal rights and justice for Palestinians or free Palestine. Is somebody in Israel, somebody who is a respected voice in the international community, how do you respond to a critique of the policies of the Israeli state, indeed of Zionism, as the underpinnings philosophically for the Israeli state as being either overt or even, some might say, nascent anti-Semitism?
It's a very cynical kind of a play by Israel, ploy by Israel. this whole anti-Semitic thing. Anti-Semitism is real. There really is anti-Semitism in the world, and it's a form of racism. And it should be fought when it's, you know, when it's genuinely expressed. But what Israel did, and it did it very deliberately and very consciously and explicitly about 10 years ago in the foreign ministry of Israel, they invented what's called the new anti-Semitism, that any criticism of Israel would be considered anti-Semitic. Then they sponsored a lot of law school symposium around it so that it got some academic credence to it. And then it got this IHRA definition out that in a very sophisticated way said any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. And there's been a very concerted campaign all over the world, in Europe, in the U.S., all over the world, really, to get governments, not only national governments, but in the U.S., state governments and universities and municipalities to adopt this definition that absolutely closes down any criticism of Israel. But it's a very cynical political ploy because criticizing Israel is not anti-Semitism, of course. And this is a blurring that Israel has created. You know, Zionism represented 3% of the Jewish people when it began. Until today, it represents a minority of the Jewish people who are really Zionists. I don't think any Jews in the United States, as much as they might like Israel and so on, really see themselves as part of a Jewish nation. They see themselves as Americans. Jews for them are a people, maybe, a culture, a religion, but not a nation. So that this whole nationalizing of Judaism is something that a small minority of Jews did, and then they did some terrible things with it. They took over Palestine, another people's country, and displaced them and dispersed them and occupied them and everything else. And then, of course, began to say, okay, we now represent the Jewish people because we are the real Jews. Part of Zionism was what was called the negation of the exile. And that is that you're Jews abroad, but you're living an ephemeral life. You're not really living as Jews. You're living in this diaspora, this exile, really. And you'll only really be Jews when you come home and become national Jews like we were in the Torah. That's a Zionist idea. And the vast majority of Jews don't accept that, except in Israel. You know, they co-opted Judaism, basically. I would even say that Zionism murdered Judaism to a large degree. And that meant then that when Netanyahu gets up in the UN, he says, I represent the Jewish people, not only Israelis. You know, he represents you. I don't know if you ever voted for Netanyahu. I don't know if you're an Israeli. I don't know if you have citizenship in Israel. But he represents you. He invades Gaza in your name, you see? And unless the American Jewish community, and actually JVP is doing this, and I think more and more Jews are doing this, not the establishment, unless the Jewish establishment says, you do not speak in our name, not in our name. You know, what you do to Palestinians, you do not do in the name of the Jewish people. Until they say that, they can't be blamed if people confuse Judaism and Jews abroad with what Israel does. Because Israel claims to be doing it in their name, and they seem to be agreeing with that. You go into a synagogue, and the rabbi's flanked by an American flag and an Israeli flag. So what are people supposed to say? Does Israel represent you or doesn't it? And if it doesn't represent you, say so. Otherwise, you fall into that trap. And I think what's happened is that Israel has really put American Jews at jeopardy. Because Israel's stepping out again as the exception, you see? Human rights, you know, there was a Jew, René Cassin, a French Jew that wrote the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And he said, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. And our human rights instruments are intended to deal with all of that. The Jews are now under the umbrella, you know, with everybody else. And that's our security. And he says to Israel at one time, are you sure you want to step out of the umbrella again? You want to be the exception? Human rights and international law apply to everybody but not to you because you're special, Israel? Do the Jews really want to be the exception again? Because that is exactly why anti-Semitism fell on them. Because we were outside of the community of nations and we were vulnerable. So what human rights does is bring us back in. So the more that Israel denies human rights, rejects human rights, says Jews are exceptional and it doesn't apply to us, and we can have an occupation, and the hell with international law, and the hell with the UN, that jeopardizes all the Jews in the world. So I think Israel has really, instead of giving Jews security, I think Israel has really put Jews in danger, and the Jews have to stand up, and finally they're beginning to do that abroad, and say, no, you do not represent us. And I think that is the way to answer these charges of anti-Semitism. You know, anti-Semitism is wrong, but it has nothing to do with Israel. If you hate me as a Jew, I want to deal with that issue. But if you hate Israel, you can hate Israel, or you can demonstrate against Israel. Israel is a country. You can do anything you want to, but leave me out of it because I'm not an Israeli. And that kind of distinction, I think, has to be made.
Push this a little further in terms of left communities, the left Jewish community in the U.S., which has always had an affection. I wouldn't say always has, but certainly does have, hasn't distanced itself from settler colonialism. I don't think it's done that terms of the issue of a racism here, and which must happen. And I don't, which has kind of made it class collaborationist, and I don't think that it's certainly done it in relationship to Zionism. So what do you say to people who consider themselves on the left for their still marked defense of the ideology of Zionism and any critique of that as equating Zionism with racism against something that is anti-Semitic?
The mistake is equating Zionism with Judaism. You see, that's what happened. There was never, Zionism was a branch of Jews that decided they're a national group and they're going to go off and start a state somewhere. They were seen as nuts by the Bunds and by the Reform Jews and by the Orthodox Jews 100 years ago. And over time, for all kinds of reasons, you know, we have a state, we have a government, we have an army, and we're and all this triumphal kind of a stuff, they took over Judaism. They actually conquered not only the Palestinians, they conquered Judaism. So the distinction isn't made today between anti-Semitism and Jews, it's between Jews and Israel. That's, you know, again the problem. So liberal Jews, first of all, have to stand up for their own Judaism. They have to validate their own experience. They have to say to Israel, no, I am not living in exile. I'm not living even in diaspora. I'm an American Jew. American Jews have a long history, a rich history. Jews in Europe, Jews in Iraq, Jews all over the world had a rich history of their own that should be Israel. You know, Zionism was a kind of a Jewish Holocaust because it took cultures, rich Jewish cultures all over the world, delegitimized them, brought them to Israel, made them banal little Mizrahi Jews and Eurovision singing people and a banal Israeli kind of a culture. And all those cultures died. Some of the cultures that still exist, beginning again in Europe, in Latin America, in other parts of the world, in the U.S. and Canada, have to reassert themselves. And I think they're beginning to do that and to reevaluate themselves. You are not Israelis. And there's more and more of a difference. And people have to understand this, that Israel is not Jewish. Judaism has been co-opted into a nationalist religion that is maybe has something to do with the genocidal Judaism of the Old Testament, of the first five books of Moses and the book of Joshua, which is really genocidal. Read the book of Joshua someday. You know, you come into the conquer the country and kill every man, woman, child, and donkey, and every living thing in the country you kill. That's the Judaism that Zionism drew from. Judaism of you guys in the U.S. and Canada is completely different. I think your Judaism comes out of the prophetic tradition. And you define yourselves by human rights. Certainly liberal Jews define themselves by human rights, by social justice. The Jews involved in the civil rights movement, Jews involved in the anti-war movements and human rights movements. You know, in Mandela's first government in South Africa, he had five white ministers, all of whom were Jewish. So that's where Jews abroad draw their Judaism from. And if they allow themselves, that their form of humanistic liberal, social justice-oriented Judaism to be co-opted and conquered and destroyed and devalidated by a conquering, nationalistic, colonializing Zionism Jewishness, they've not only committed suicide, but they've done a tremendous injustice to Judaism. They have acquiesced in the murdering of Judaism. So I think what liberal Jews have to do is stand up for themselves. And stand up and say, we are a community in and of ourselves. We have our history. We have a validity to being ourselves. We have a point of view. We have values that are not Israeli nationalist colonial values, and we're different from you guys. And we wish you well, but you are not us. And that has to happen. And I don't think liberal Jews understand the degree to which Zionism has really murdered any form of Judaism that they would recognize and want to be a part of as Judaism. People are beginning to understand today is that Zionism was a settler colonial movement. So that it's the whole logic and dynamic of Zionism and the Judaism that it kind of co-opted in order to make itself go, said, you know, we're the exclusive owners of this country. There are no other people here. This is a land without a people. We're coming back and filling that vacuum. And the bunch of Arabs that are here that don't add up to a people have to either get out or be displaced because we want the land. It's our land and it's our country. In terms of Israeli-Jewish dialogue, even a recognition, acknowledgement of a Palestinian people, it's not there. In other words, there's an Israeli-Jewish nationality here that owns the country and all of the land and is completely right. It has an exclusive claim. And there are a bunch of Arabs that have no history and no identity and no national claims and no right to self-determination that are simply kind of standing in our way. You know, so we've criminalized their resistance. There can't be resistance to us because we're right and they don't have any rights. So that we have to criminalize all their resistance is terrorism. And there's no dialogue. If Israel would acknowledge the existence, not only the right of a Palestinian people here, that would undermine its entire claim to ownership over the country, over the land of Israel. Now we'd have to really deal with them. Only by erasing them from the country, erasing their presence as much as possible, and turning them into a bunch of people that aren't a nation, maybe a little ethnic group or religious groups or something like that, that have no national rights, only by doing that can we assert our exclusive claim to the country. That was part of the anger of the Palestinians, not just the anger, but the realization of the Palestinians, both in Israel and in the occupied territory after these Gaza attacks and attack on Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah and all of that, that there is no political process. Israel will never recognize them. There is no coexistence. There is no future, and therefore they have to get their own act together. And they have to somehow, beating Israel militarily doesn't seem to be an option, but at the same time, negotiating with Israel is no option because Israel won't negotiate with them and recognize them. What do we do now? And I think that's where the Palestinians are. I think they're in a process of withdrawing a little bit into themselves, and they have to figure out what in the hell they want, where they are, what their agenda is before they can begin to reemerge politically. That's where I see the whole thing, and Israel is simply pushing all the time, pushing the final stages of Judaization of the country. That's what we call Zionism. We said Zionism itself said we came to Judaize this country, to turn an Arab country into a Jewish country, and we're in the last stages. And Israel is right now. It seems like it feels that it's mopping up operations, and the Palestinians are really in a pretty desperate situation.
Let's deal with another difficult question that has consumed people here, again, who are trying to quiet the voice, if not silence it, of people who, again, stand for equal rights and justice for the Palestinian people, and that is the question of equivalency. What is a poor nation to do, notwithstanding its Iron Dome technology, et cetera, to deflect the missiles of Hamas, but what is a poor nation to do when we are under attack. We are still the Davids being potentially consumed by the broader Arab Goliath in the Middle East region. So how do you also respond to that issue of equivalency of power and death to justify or to rationalize the force that's been used against the Palestinian people?
You see, that very question comes out of the dilemmas of settler colonialism. The settler colonialism can never be normalized. It craves to be normalized. A settler state craves to be, Israel craves to be a country where you look at Israel and you go to the tourist office and you look at a poster for come to Israel and you think of it as a Jewish country, as Israel in the kibbutz in Hebrew, and you don't think of Arab. It just naturally think about it as a Jewish country. That's the normalization, and countries recognize it, that it's a part of the international system. That's what settler colonialism wants. It can never reach that. It's not like here, but, you know, the Native Americans in the U.S., you know, they haven't shut down the Native American issue over all these centuries, even. I mean, it's still there. Here, I think it's much stronger because the Palestinians still have national aspirations. They're a larger, more stronger community than, let's say, the Native Americans in the U.S. But settler colonialism is a conquering colonial enterprise. It comes in to take someone else's country and to take their land and displace them. So the people who are oppressed, who are colonized, can never normalize with that, can never stop resisting. They can be suppressed. There'd be industrial quiet for a while. They can try to negotiate, although it'll never happen because the settlers want the whole country. That's the whole point of Zionism and settler colonialism. And so structurally, that kind of violence and a disproportional violence, there's no equivalency here. That's why we reject the idea of both sides. There's no symmetry here. You have one strong settler colonial project, a state, that has managed to conquer the country by force. And you have a people scattered without their lands anymore, with no government and no army and no real international support, trying to resist. So there is no equivalency here. But their resistance is structural. There has to be. They can't possibly simply accept the fact that they're going to live under an apartheid regime and occupation and oppression and displacement forever. They can't do that. And I think that's where settler colonialism is such a powerful analytical tool. Because all these years we've talked about, we framed it as a conflict. It's a conflict that has two sides. That creates the equivalency. Now both sides should stop the violence. Both sides should negotiate. Both sides should compromise. But there isn't both sides. There's no two sides. There's no equivalence in power. And there's no equivalence from the point of view of the political goals. Settler colonialism is unilateral. The Zionists came here with the goal of taking over the country, not of compromising, not of taking over 78% of the country, not of acknowledging there's another people here that they can't do because this is our country, but taking over the country. And that has never changed, and that continues to be the agenda. So, of course, there's resistance to that on the part of the – and not only haven't they managed to displace the Palestinians – completely from the country, from their lands, yes. But the majority of the population today is Palestinian in this country, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, before the millions of Palestinian refugees return. So this kind of a conflict, and Israel can't resolve it. That's the problem. Because a settler colonial regime can't decolonize itself. Why would Israel want to decolonize? Why would the whites in South Africa want to end apartheid? They're on top. They have all the land. They have all the resources. They're enjoying power. You know, they have international acceptance. What motivation do they have to dismantle the whole thing and give Palestinians equal rights? There isn't any. That's why, you know, we're in a very strange dilemma where the strong power that has the power to make peace, a just peace, and deal with Palestinian rights won't do it, can't do it, because it goes against the very purpose of it, which is to take over the country. And so what we have to do is what they did in South Africa, what the FLN did in Algeria, and that is bypass the colonial population. Here, the Israeli Jewish population and the government, and go to you people, to the international civil society around the world, the peoples around the world that are mobilized in many ways for Palestinians, and begin to advocate for a solution, a Palestinian solution, not an Israeli, that Israelis will never agree to a solution that actually dismantles and decolonizes their apartheid system, their colonial system. So the Palestinians have to come up with it, supported by as many critical Jews like me as possible, like whites. Some whites supported the ANC in South Africa, supported by the global peoples of the world. And then to create pressures that cause this apartheid regime to collapse. That's the only way forward is through act, not violence necessarily, but certainly through political pressure, economic boycotts, changing of government policies, all kinds of things like that, plus resistance from within, to make the whole thing collapse. And then when you get to a point where it's collapsed, then the Israeli Jews might be in a mood, like the whites in South Africa were, to go through a transition period. Once they can't hold on to the dominant colonial system anymore, they're forced to deal with the indigenous population, then we have a chance to get into a process like they did in South Africa of decolonizing the apartheid regime. I mean, it is an important precedent. You know, it's the first time that an Arab party, we don't use the word Palestinian in Israel, an Arab party was able to actually get into a government coalition. So that created an important precedent, and maybe we can build on that. But what we have to understand is that this is an Islamic party, and it has a religious agenda. It does not have a national agenda. That's one reason why it broke away from the Joint Arab List, because its agenda is religious. So that actually the truth is that Mahmoud Abbas, who's the head of RAM, this Islamic party, preferred to go into government with Netanyahu. He prefers the right wing to the left wing. I mean, you don't think about that in terms of Palestinians, but think of him not as a Palestinian necessarily, because he represents in many ways Bedouins who are a little bit Palestinian, not Palestinian, and so on. But at the same time, he's religious. His agenda is a fundamentalist religious Islamic agenda. So he's much more concerned. You know, for example, Israel passed this nationalities law that puts the Arab population in Israel legally, structurally, in a second-class position. He doesn't say, I'm coming into the government now, let's change that. That's not his agenda. He doesn't talk about the occupation, Palestinians, rights. His issue is gay, lesbian, LGBTQ rights. That's his agenda. What he doesn't like, you know, the parties that come into this new liberal, not liberal, but center coalition, right-wing center coalition that Bennett and Lapid have formed, the two of the parties are the Labor Party, Meretz, and Lapid's party, are all for LGBTQ rights. So he would rather go into a coalition with the right-wing, real right-wing, like Netanyahu, who's against that, in a way, or at least who, you know, has religious parties in his coalition that are against that, then go into a secular coalition that doesn't have religious parties like this new coalition that's founded. So we have to, you know, we can't take Palestinians as whole cloth and assume that because they're Palestinians, they have particular positions. This is an Arab party representing Bedouins that have local issues of housing rights and village rights and land rights and so on, who are very religious, who are very concerned about the LGBTQ issue, and that's their agenda. From the point of view of a party, a Palestinian party representing Palestinian interests and a Palestinian perspective, that is not RAM. So from that point of view, it's not really very helpful. The same with Hamas, by the way. Hamas said last week, we'll attack you again, Israel. Why? Not for Palestinian rights, not because of the occupation, house demolitions, settlements. We'll attack you if you touch Al-Aqsa Mosque. But that's really the main issue for the Palestinians, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So, you know, all these religious fundamentalist parties, I mean, I don't like them, the Jewish parties, I don't like the evangelical parties, and I don't like the Islamic parties. I don't think they represent the political needs of their people.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg for Equal Rights and Justice. We're speaking with Jeff Halper on Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for One Democratic State. But take us back so that we can understand now the significance or what it portends that we have this coalition now that has pushed Netanyahu out, and yet we have Naftali Bennett, who is perhaps right to the right, who comes from the settler culture, which has been the major threat to the land base, among other things,
right,
of the integrity of a Palestinian state, a Palestinian cohesion. So help us understand what you think this new coalition in effect means.
It goes back to what I've been saying before. If you're an Israeli, forget Palestinians. They're not an issue. The whole idea of the settler colonial project, the settler colonial isn't just an academic concept. It has a logic to it that if you don't understand it, you can't really interpret what's happening. And the idea is, in settler colonialism, that we want to create a Jewish society here and normalize it and erase any Palestinian presence, whether it's physical or political or cultural or on the land or food or anything else. We're off your food. People think about falafel, they think about Israeli falafel. You know, we've co-opted Palestinian food. That's what's happening. And in that kind of situation, then, the Palestinians disappear. And they've certainly been erased from the Israeli consciousness. Before the last election, the Haaretz newspaper did a survey of what's on the minds of Israelis. What are they voting for? What issues are important to them? You, in the U.S., talk about Israel-Palestine. You think immediately, I think, of, most people do, of occupation and conflict and war and Gaza and missiles and all that. Not Israelis. For them, what we're talking about, occupation and the political process, Palestinians, was number 11 on the list of priorities. You know, Arabs are behind, we don't see them, they're behind walls, they're in isolated enclaves, we don't feel them, we feel a great sense of personal security, we let the army take care of them, the Arabs. And okay, once in a while you get a Gaza kind of a thing. It's hard for me to convey to you that 24 hours after the ceasefire, it's as if it never happened. We're absolutely back to normal. You know what people were talking about the day after? The Eurovision. That Israel didn't win the Eurovision. Everybody's watching the Eurovision. As you were talking about, concerned about the ceasefire, we're looking at the Eurovision and our song contest with Europe. And everything is back to absolute normal and the political process and Netanyahu and Lapid and Bennett and all this stuff. So it's hard to convey how much the Palestinians are a non-issue. So this new government has decided, so it's a right-wing government, because the whole idea that of settler colonialism, of Zionism taking over the country, is accepted by the Labor Party, by the Zionist left, by Meretz. Don't forget, settler colonial project was a Labor Party project. There was no Likud in those days. This is Ben-Gurion. This is the Labor Party. And the Labor Party is the one that conquered the West Bank in 1967 in Gaza and Jerusalem. It's the Labor Party that started the settlements. It's the Labor Party that started the wall. So, you can't blame the Likud. This isn't the right. This idea that this is our country and we have to repress the Palestinians and their resistance is just terrorism and they have no rights here, this is a wall-to-wall accepted concept in Israel. And some want to go further, like Naftali Bennett, they want to annex the West Bank. And some, like the liberals and the Labor Party and Meretz, want to make life better for them in their little enclaves or whatever. The whole issue of what we're talking about, really genuinely trying to reach a political settlement with the Palestinians, is not an issue but for any of the parties. So what is this government's agenda then? And this is the point of it. Because it's putting the right wing and the left wing together, they're going to focus on domestic issues that they can agree on. They're going to focus on health, education, infrastructure, economy, and they're not going to deal with the Palestinian issue. That's the agreement. That shows you the fact that you have a new Israeli government that says we can function normally as a government over 4 years without dealing with the Palestinians. Simply focusing on domestic affairs shows the degree to which the whole Palestinian issue has been marginalized in Israel. And that's really the story, is that this new government isn't just a right-wing government. It's a government that agrees that the Palestinian issue is marginal and we'll deal with it someday down the line. There's a real antagonism between Ram, the Islamic Party, and the other three parties of the Joint Arab List. Ram wants it to take over, basically, the Arab population in Israel and try to eliminate, even as much as possible, the Joint Arab List. So the fact that Ram is in doesn't mean that they'll relate to the demands of the Joint Arab List that are much broader, that have to do with voting rights, that have to do with ending the nationalities law, that have to do with the land issues, and that have to do with the political process with the Palestinians. So that the Ram party has none of that. They're only interested in the Bedouins of the Negev. Now, it's not really clear that they've extracted any concessions. In a very minor way, maybe 13 of hundreds of unrecognized Bedouin communities in the Negev, 13 will be recognized and maybe go through some development. But you see, the problem with that is that if Israel for a long time has wanted to end the wider Bedouin presence in the Negev and concentrate them in a few townships where they can be controlled, and then the land of the Negev, of course, goes again to settlement. It's the same process inside Israel as it is in the West Bank. There's a whole, this whole Arakib community of Bedouins, it's now been destroyed about 185 times and rebuilt by its inhabitants. Why is it being destroyed so much? Because there's a plan to build a settlement for military officers on their land. So it's the same occupation process. You know, we haven't finished 1948, so that all Rob did is they got some villages recognized, they'll get some, they call it development, but it's really concentrating Bedouin populations in townships with no infrastructure, no economy, that then you can ship them out to casual labor in the Jewish communities, so that really doesn't help them much. You destroy the Bedouin life. And, you know, there'll be, again, maybe some religious benefits. You know, they'll build some more mosques, so they'll do some, you know, support religious communities. That might happen, certainly. But for the Bedouin community as a whole, you know, the policy of demolishing homes in the Palestinian, in the Bedouin community, which is a real issue, I think the agreement was to put off any decision until 3 or 4 years from now. Not to cancel the demolitions, but simply to delay them. So I don't think much, really tremendous concessions have been made to the Bedouins. And certainly that doesn't carry over into the other Arab parties.
I want to turn our attention now to your new book, Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for One Democratic State. Talk about the premise of that book and whether or not there is any will on the ground, either from a progressive Israeli sector and or any support from the BDS movement for such, and certainly from the Palestinian side.
I'm part of a group. I'm still the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, but I'm part of a group that our committee supports that's a Palestinian-led group. It was begun by Palestinians called the One Democratic State Campaign. And what we're saying is you cannot be in a political struggle without an end game. The fatal flaw of the Palestinian struggle until now, there's no political program. I mean, the whole idea of two states that the Palestinian Authority still holds on to is ridiculous. Not only is it dead and gone under the settlements, of course, two states, but again, if you go back and recognize settler colonialism, you understand that Israel never had the intention of creating a Palestinian state. It goes against the very fundamental principles of Zionism. They claim that this is our country, and what we call the West Bank, Judea and Samaria for Zionists, is the heart of the land of Israel. They'd create a Palestinian state in Tel Aviv before they create a Palestinian state in Hebron, so that we're left then with a political struggle of Palestinians that is very strong in many ways. You know, the international community, you see this after these attacks on Gaza, has really come out, especially in the U.S., on the side of the Palestinians. BDS has had an impact. There's campaigns, there's hundreds of groups all over the world, but we're missing an end game. What are we BDSing for? And the three elements of BDS aren't a political program. End the occupation. That's a good idea, but what does that mean? What are you going to replace the occupation with? BDS is a tool. It's not a standalone thing. The BDS people are making a tremendous mistake by not linking it to a political program. All the BDS work we did with South Africa, the whole anti-apartheid struggle, always had an end game. One person, one vote. So anything that happened, de Klerk would come to Mandela and offer power sharing. Whatever was offered, we all knew and supported one person, one vote. We don't have that with Palestine. We don't have a political program. If Biden says to us, well, what do you want? We don't have an answer. What do we want? It's not end the occupation, because occupation is 22% of the country. What about the other 78%? And so we're trying to present a political program for that deals with settler colonialism, because you've got to deal with the real issue. So we talk about decolonizing Zionism, dismantling all the structures of domination and control and replacing it with a democratic state with equal rights for everyone, an inclusive state. In other words, Israelis remain. The whole concept is this already is a country. Between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, this is a country. Call it what you will. And in this country, all the people have a right to be here, are inhabitants of the country, and should simply have equal rights, including, of course, Palestinian refugees that have a right to return. Now, the state's not going to be a Jewish state, of course. The minority of the population is Jewish. At the same time, we have to also see it's not going to be a Palestinian state because 30, 40% of the population will be Jewish. Both sides have to swallow that pill and begin to look at a society that we're sharing together. And this idea of a shared society, a shared political community, a shared civil society based on equal rights actually goes back to what this country was like and the Middle East was like before colonialism, before the British and the French came into this region in the early 20th century or later 19th century. And that is the Middle East was really a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural, multinational mosaic of peoples. And there were more railroads in the 19th century here than there are today. And peoples lived all over the place, and the chief rabbi for the Jews of this whole region was in Istanbul with the Sultan, and there were local chief rabbis, and Jews lived with Muslims, and they had businesses together, and Jews and Christians did business with Europe, and the whole region was one region. There wasn't states and nations and borders and all this stuff that the Europeans imported. So in a sense, the concept of one state, a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multinational state, actually goes back more. I mean, we're stuck with the state idea because that's been imposed on the whole world by the Europeans. But within that, we can go back to the idea of a shared life that we used to have that I think we can have again. So we have a 10-point political program that I write about in the book, but you can look it up on our – we have a website called onestatecampaign.org. That says we want a state with a constitution of equal rights for everyone. Also, we recognize that people do have their collective identities. There are Israeli Jews. There are Palestinian Arabs. There are Russians in this country that identify as Russians, not as Israelis. You know, we've got about a couple hundred thousand of them. You have African asylum seekers here, tens of thousands. So it is a multicultural kind of a society here. Bedouins might want their own identity, Circassians, you have Armenians here, you have Roma here, you've got all kinds of groups, not only Palestinians and Israelis. So the idea is you can keep your identity. As long as you're living within a democratic state, you can be a Zionist, you can be a Muslim fundamentalist, whatever you want to be. That over time, as we live together, and as we share the land, and as we share the economy, which would be a good economy, and as we share our political life and so on, and share sport, maybe together our soccer team will get into the World Cup one day. Take the Super Bowl and multiply it 1,000 times, and that's the World Cup. The Palestinian football team, they call it football here, not soccer, the Palestinian soccer team is ranked higher in the international standings than the Israeli team. But neither team has managed to get into the World Cup. We got close a few times. Can you imagine in this new one state of ours, where we're still maybe in a little bit of a conflict, there's tensions, we're still getting used to each other, living together, that our combined national team gets into the World Cup? And all of a sudden, there's an us. It's our team. I don't think anything would galvanize a local population here like that would. Since we've never gotten into the World Cup, we have to have a local team to root for. Who do we root for? Israelis root for Egypt, because Egypt does get in. And even during the qualifying games, when they're playing other African countries in Egypt, every game gets thousands of Israelis, or used to, maybe not these days, but certainly a few years ago, thousands of Israelis would go to Cairo and would root for the Egyptian team waving Egyptian flags. They're our team in the World Cup, even until today. But if we had our own team, all I'm saying is if we could imagine a new situation where there's a new us begins to emerge from daily life, a new political community, which I think is very possible. We had that at one point before Zionism. We had a shared community, a shared community here. That is the way forward. The only way forward, where that's the only end you can have to settler colonialism. It restores the Palestinians to their sovereignty and their rights and their community and their lands. It also, you know, in some ways, allows Zionists finally to really settle down and become a part of the Middle East, which is what they always wanted, but they've never been able to achieve that. They've always been seen as a foreign, hostile element. So for both sides, I think, it really is a win-win proposition. And I, you know, if this is the political program or not, there's got to be a political program inserted into this struggle, or else we're lost. Because you guys aren't going to liberate Palestine from the U.S. unless you have direction and a focus and a program to advocate for and mobilize around, articulated by Palestinians and supported by some Israelis. You can't go anywhere. You're floundering. And that's why we're not able to exploit the energy that's been released after Gaza for the Palestinians, because we don't have any ask. We don't have a political program that we're advocating for, and that's what we're trying to insert into this process.
Really two questions, which are one, what's the ask of Biden? But to broaden that most strategically, for those of us in the U.S. who do support a free, free Palestine, right, what is our ask? I mean, we know of the astronomical bill incurred for right. U.S. support yearly of the militarism employed against the Palestinian right. people by the Israeli government. What, right. as we do and will continue to support BDS as a form of pressure, and I get it, what's the end game that we're supporting absolutely and unequivocally? What should be the pressure point? What should be the ask or demand, shall we say, of the U.S. government in response to the continuing abuse, the human rights abuse, the totality of efforts to try to erase the nation of Palestine and its people from the landmass and effectively the region, really?
That's our weakness. That's the whole point. We do not have an ask. A political program that we can go to Biden with and say, or to go to AOC and Sanders with and say, push, this is what we want to push with the American government. We don't have it. So what we're left with are...
Can we develop that and take your counsel and make sure that decolonizing Israel, liberating Palestine, Zionism, settler colonialism,
That's
and
right.
the case for one democratic state, a must-read? Do we at least demand, do we continue our protests of protest unloading Israeli ships in our docks?
That's
do
right.
we,
right.
more importantly, really, of the government, because that's one strategic thing to do, that people are protesting. But the more strategic thing of, do we say cut off the money? Do we cut off the 501c3s and tax incentives and other things that propel further settler colonialism
of
more Palestinian land?
That's right. But you see, all that begs the question, to what end? You do all that, so what? I mean, what? Okay, you cut off aid, you cut off military, you cut off this, you cut off this, you do this. To what end? I mean, it's not resolving anything. You see, so the answer to your question is yes. We have to keep doing everything we're doing. We have to keep doing BDS. We have to keep trying to boycott ships sending materials to Israel. We have to try to stop funding Israeli military stuff. We have to put pressure to stop settlements. We have to try, I mean, we certainly could stop house demolitions. That's something you could even do if you support a two-state solution. You know, Israel's demolished 150,000 Palestinian homes since 1948 and ongoing. That could end. I mean, there's a million things that you can do, and there are a million different programs. You know, you've got problems with the wall. You got issues of Bedouins. You have issues of the Jordan. I mean, there's 1,000 issues. The issue of the Lift the Village, now that they want to destroy it and build some Jewish neighborhood on it. I mean, there's no end of issues. That's part of the problem. You can run around chasing all these issues all the time in a reactive sort of a way, but there's no proactive resolution of anything. So until we have, and here we have to wait on the Palestinians. There's nothing else to do. We can't. We meaning Israeli Jews and you guys abroad, we can't represent Palestinians. We have to actually just kind of stand to the side to some degree, do what we do to support them, do what we do to prevent Israel from harming them in any way. But that's all we can do until such a time as a political program emerges that we can mobilize around. And that's what our group is really trying to press upon the Palestinians, that's the urgent agenda, their agenda item.
Jeff, to what extent?
Well, it's very –
You did this – yeah.
Yeah, it's not taking hold greatly. I tell you, the problem isn't the one-state idea. Palestinians have always supported one state. That was the PLO's idea 50, 60 years ago. The problem is people are exhausted, certainly in the occupied territory. They're exhausted. They're barely surviving. They're living under two occupations, the Israeli occupation and the Palestinian Authority occupation, which is almost no less friendly, and they don't have the mental and political space to think about this stuff even. And in addition, you know, one state sounds utopian, even though it isn't. And actually, we have one state already today. We have already one apartheid state. There is only one government between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. So it's not a matter of once creating one state. It's a matter of taking the one state that already existed, Israel created, and transforming it from an apartheid regime into a democratic state. That's it. So it isn't really such a tremendous thing to get to wrap your head around. And I think it's very doable if we seriously do it. The problem is that, you know, the Palestinians are very fragmented. Hopefully now after Gaza, there's beginning to be more of a unity and more communication, but they all have different agendas. You know, the refugees have their agendas in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan, where they have their own problems. Palestinians in Israel have their problems, and of course the Palestinians in the north are different than the Palestinians in the south. You see that with Ram and the Joint Arab List that are at each other's throats. Palestinians in the West Bank have their issues. In Gaza have their issues. Abroad have their issues. So, you know, it's going to be it's a process, and we're trying to push as much as we can, but I don't know. I really don't know when it's going to come, but in the meantime, I guess what we have to keep doing to answer your question are these rear guard actions, keeping Palestine on the map, trying to prevent Israel as much as possible from harming Palestinians, and hoping that at some point we'll get this political program out that we can really seriously begin to mobilize around. Until then, we're sort of in a rear guard, reactive sort of a state, I guess.
Well, Jeff Halper, always thank you for your wisdom and, most importantly, your work on the ground, which, of course, continues in response to the demolition of Palestinian housing. Is there a final how we can get in touch with you? And I will say, again, a must-read book. You need to read it. Your final thoughts?
We have to really think about, and if we're Palestinian – and if we're supporting the Palestinians, we have to have the same. We have to push for a political solution. We have to push the Palestinians, and we have to begin to try to get Palestinians to go beyond resistance, and beyond protest, and beyond documenting what's going on, and beyond human rights to really begin to formulate. And they have to do it, a political program that we can all get behind. So that's the call of the day, I guess, and that's really what I'm trying to urge. Otherwise, you know, people can look up our program on onestatecampaign.org. They can follow ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, at ICAHD.org. You know, they can always be in touch with me. I'm happy to respond to people and write to people. I'm jeffhalper@gmail.com. So people are welcome to contact me if they want.
Certainly, what is happening in the U.S., there is a vigorous, youthful movement of Jews, mm-hmm. Jewish Voices for Peace, and many other groups, people who have largely coalesced around the BDS movement, but many other facets of concern, who are saying not in my name. And there's an energy and there's a vigor and there's a refusal to be baited as anti-Semitic and thus silenced. Do you see that? And do you is such in Israel? And do you see a cause for hope that there is a new youthful energy, and indeed from the Palestinian youth as well, that can take us to this programmatic concern that will really create a state where people can live from all different groups with equal rights and justice?
I think it's really good. It's really great what's happened in the American community, in American public opinion, in generating greater support for the Palestinian and greater understanding for the Palestinian issue. The Palestinians are very isolated. That's one reason why they're not thinking politically. They're isolated. They're just surviving in the West Bank, certainly in Gaza. They don't know that there's a huge BDS movement. They don't know that there's JVP and the U.S. campaign and that thousands of people have gone out for them. They don't see that. All they see is this Israeli, you know, military arm on their necks. And so I think the organizations abroad have a responsibility to inform Palestinians that they have this international support in order to encourage them to continue their political efforts and not to retreat, you know, into a kind of a despair, really. And so I think these organizations in the U.S. that support Palestinian rights have to rethink and reinvigorate working relations with both Palestinian and Israeli activists here.
We've been speaking with Jeff Halper on Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for One Democratic State. I'm Mimi Rosenberg for a special message. If you're a member of WBAI, you've been emailed a ballot from the Pacifica Foundation. That's if you've provided an email address. Otherwise, you'll receive your ballot by mail. Now, if you can't locate your ballot, first make sure it didn't inadvertently go to spam. Okay, you found it. So now the question is, which side are you on? Do you choose an inclusive democracy where you, the member, and I, the worker, get to have a real voice in the decisions that make this people's media network run? Or do you vote for those who supported the hijackers who, in October 2019, at gunpoint, locked us out of our studios and replaced our local programming, and who have long played with the idea of selling WBAI? It's up to you to decide. Do you decide on democracy? A BAI, a Pacifica, where decisions are made by the people, for the people? Or on a self-appointed, self-perpetuating, non-elected, corporate-style CEO structure, and with its return to toothless advisory boards to mask their autocracy? Well, I know which side I'm on. Which side are you on? Cast your vote. Cast it now. The future of Pacifica is in your hands. Every vote counts. Vote for democracy. I'm Mimi Rosenberg for Equal Rights and Justice. Organize, organize, and organize, because another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.
Everyone is fighting for equal rights and justice. Palestinians fighting for equal rights and justice.
This is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time.